My idea for this week is that we can come together and do some spirituality instead of just thinking and talking about it. And there's some real high, powerful theologians working with us this week, and that's exciting. And each of these sessions will be such that you can come to all of them or check in when you don't want to go to another one. And we'll try to be self-contained in each session and just look at some various ways that we can approach spirituality and maybe share together some spiritual directions, some spiritual exercises. My name is Dan Gesslin. I'm an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ, and I'm also have experience as a family therapist and a chemical dependency counselor. And I've tried in my career to keep like one foot in the church and pastoring and the other foot in the secular world in psychology and therapy. And before my current position as co-pastor of Spirit of the Lakes United Church of Christ in Minneapolis, I was primary therapist at the Pride Institute in Minneapolis, which is a chemical dependency clinic. This evening we're going to look at 12-step spirituality very briefly, just as a place to jump off. Tomorrow we'll use feminist spirituality as a similar jumping off point, and we'll talk about the spirituality of friendship later in the week, and finally a covenantal sense of spirituality. How can we come together and share our spiritualities in community without getting doctrinaire about it and having to take sides about who's right and wrong? So this is not a 12-step meeting. no one needs to like come out if you are part of a 12-step program, but a lot of people don't know about, you know, what is 12-step spirituality all about. And as I've worked in 12-step programs, I've found more and more that there's something happening there that I think could be healing for churches to look at as a form for approaching spirituality. I started getting interested in this two summers ago when Frederick Buechner, who is a Presbyterian clergy person who left the parish and moved to a remote farm in Vermont and started writing religious books, many of which are in the bookstore, on spirituality. He spoke in Minneapolis about exactly 2 years ago, and he made the statement that really intrigued me, that the reason that the middle class churches in this country are dying is that the Holy Spirit has moved into 12-step programs. And that's where people are coming together and finding real community. That's where I feel like I recognize who 12-step people are, because there's lights going on, like agreement. That's where community really is. That's where spiritual growth is happening. That's where relationship with God is happening. We could discuss whether or not that's true, but that Fred Buechner said that was interesting, and I thought it was pretty interesting too. The original revelation, which is how Alcoholics Anonymous would talk about it, of the 12 steps, happened, of course, in the community of alcoholics, and it has worked in that community, and now is being used as a model, and not only in various forms of addiction, but also chemical dependency addictions, but also in behavior compulsive problems that people have. And I thought maybe the easiest way of approaching this ecumenically would be to follow the Al-Anon wording Al-Anon began as a program of spiritual growth and wholeness for partners and spouses and family members of alcoholics. What is currently known as family system therapy, which I guess is mainstream these days, came out of the realization that alcoholism is not an individual problem, but the whole family gets involved in the disease, and that not only the alcoholic or addicted person needs to recover, but all of those in primary relationship with him or her need to recover also. And out of this comes that ever increasingly popular word codependency. In Minnesota, we say that everyone is codependent if you live in Minnesota. Which is sometimes also referred to as the land of 10,000 treatment centers. But let's go through these first three basic steps. And I was just reading the description of a dysfunctional family, which to me sounded very much like a normal church. The three don'ts: don't trust, don't feel, and don't talk. That sounded a lot like church to me. That would be what we're trying to recover from. So we admitted we were powerless over other people's behavior and that our lives had become unmanageable trying to control others. So as a, for example, a woman who has been the wife of a man who's been actively alcoholic for 20 years has developed all sorts of behaviors herself trying to control her husband's behavior, and she needs to recover from that. And we, to a greater or lesser extent, I think we all develop those kind of patterns of behavior. The second step is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, could break this compulsive behavior. And the third step is that we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God as we understood God. What I'd like to talk about and then do some exercises ourselves is, once again, not to have a 12-step meeting ourselves, but what's the process that we can, the spiritual process that we can see going on in these steps that maybe we could apply to our life together as a church. The first step involves moving from denial to acceptance. And we don't need to be identified as addicted or compulsive, I don't think, to have a feeling in our lives that we want to change things about ourselves. We want to change perhaps how we relate to other people. As we're here at Holden in community, and we're often with a lot of strangers, and we get in those discussions, and sometimes they're heated. I mean, how many of us have the experience of walking away and then for the next hour thinking, I should have said this, I could have said that, I wish I had behaved in this way, I wish I had dealt with conflict in this way or another way other than the way that I have. More importantly, I think those of us who were here last week and talked about gay and lesbians in the church, what was exciting for me in the kind of culminating forum about that was guests who seemed to come through this breakthrough experience of saying in the forum, well, it's been great that these seven or eight gay and lesbian people have been here and we're talking about their sexuality and their relationship with the church, but we should take that as an inspiration and talk about our own sexuality in the church, and move away from the unconscious ethic we seem to have in the church, which is that the last thing you talk about in church are your personal problems. The last thing you do in church is reveal who you really are. So that church becomes a whole community of denial, in which we lift up what we're all supposed to be, and we don't deal with who we really are, nor how we get to where we're supposed to be. And this is the 12 steps are a process of getting there. And that's, it's like this missing link, perhaps, between the law and the gospel. And the 12th step is based on this idea that it's acceptance, that we stop denying and we start accepting what the problem is. It's a transformation from the way most of us were brought up, that if we have a problem, we fight it. This idea that there's a battle between good and evil, or there's a battle between the spirit and the flesh, or whatever you're battling in your life, that we give up the battle, and we accept the problem, and by accepting it, we can start dealing with it in a realistic way. So it's an integrative process rather than a battling process. And if we're in a state of denial, whether it's serious addictive behavior or serious codependent behavior or workaholic behavior or dogmatic behavior, the denial process takes the place of the spirit in our lives, because more and more and more we need to protect this secret that we have, that we're not perfect like they're saying we're supposed to be in church. So we start developing all sorts of behaviors to protect the secret of our lives, that we're not what we're supposed to be. If we just accept that we're not what we're supposed to be, and then, as we move through the steps, why 12-step programs work, we form a new kind of community that's based not on being perfect people, but that what we share is that we're not perfect, and we're all accepting that. Then we have a whole new basis for community that maybe has some even gospel parallels to the Jesus community. The second step then is coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. First we have to accept that we're in the process of something we want to change. Once we accept that and start dealing with it, then we can move to the second step about looking for a power greater than ourselves. The problem beforehand has kept us in isolation and fear. The greatest fear is that someone is going to find out who I really am. The town I lived in before I moved into this church, I got divorced. And now that I'm in this new town, in this new church, and I've heard several sermons about the evil of divorce, I can't tell anyone in this church community that I'm a divorced person. So I live in isolation because this important part of my life is being hid, and I also grow increasingly in fear, because how can I be in coffee hour and people ask me, where did you used to live? What did you used to do? And I have to be thinking, well, gee, if I say this much, they might run into somebody at the supermarket in the next town who will tell them that I was divorced, and then everyone will know, and then I'll be outcast from this community. A kind of dumb example, maybe from the 50s. But we get all involved in this isolation and fear and hiding ourselves. What we want to move into is a faith community, not a fear community, and we want to move out of isolation into communion. But that's only going to work if it's a communion based on acceptance of people as they really are. And that faith and communion is somehow going to be revealed in a community. So many people have been abused by the church, that even abusing the word God is really difficult. Alcoholics, we're experiencing that. 70 years ago, when Alcoholics Anonymous started emerging and chose this term higher power as a term that could help people get back to spirituality, even though they felt ostracized and punished by the church. And it's certainly a sign of our times that more and more and more different kinds of people are finding greater attractiveness to words like higher power than words like God, because more and more and more groups of people are feeling alienated from the church, which is sad, but seemingly true. So when you go into a 12-step program, a great deal of attention is placed on helping people get in touch with the spirituality that does, and languaging it in such a way that it doesn't trigger abuse issues that they have suffered in their lives at the hands of religion and church. And that's why the third step is worded in the way that it is. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God as we understood God. So there's always this qualifying reference to God or higher power, that it's how the person understands God. So when we move into 12-step spirituality and 12-step community, we are not making a commitment to a doctrinal system. We're not making a commitment to a confession of faith. We're making a commitment to the community of people who really exist and through whom the spirituality is going to be revealed to us and with us and through us. And this, although it's moving and increasing in our time and place, these insights are not, I don't think, revolutionarily new. I mean, the Talmud, the Jewish reflections on scripture thousands of years ago said, I don't see the world as it is, I see the world as I am, which is like modern existentialism. Are there any kind of basic questions on this? Because if not, I would like to simply move into a short guided meditation and then have us talk about what that experience of the guided meditation has been, so we can kind of incarnate this instead of just talking about it. Dan?
Could you just say a word about point three there, the willful powerlessness turning to willful, willing, powerful action?
The concept is that, yeah, I sort of talked about it without making the formal transition, that business about we become powerless in our relation to our addiction or our compulsive behavior or our dogma, you know, or our sports fanaticism, whatever it is that puts us, that separates us, alienates us from what's truly valuable in our lives, or that divorce model. We're powerless over the fact, but we become willfully engaged in all of our attention. It becomes an idolatry. All of our attention goes into trying to protect our powerlessness instead of accepting it. And then hopefully through this process of turning it over to our higher power, or getting that relationship with our own spirituality, which we experience from within and in community, not from on high or not through an outside authority, we can take willful and powerful action. It's an empowering movement to get back on our own spiritual center and live in connection with that higher power, which comes to spiritual health. It's a very spiritual movement. spirituality is seen as, the right relationship with spirituality is seen as the cause and solution of all other problems. So it's not about it's not about stop drinking, or when you go to Overeaters Anonymous, it's not about stop eating. It's about what's the spiritual hole in your life that you're filling up with these other behaviors. Does it make sense that for me that this step in how we form community is the most essential, and the one that I think we can use as a critique for a lot of our churches? Do people resonate with that, or do you not have that experience? This idea that, as one of my professors used to say in seminary, the thing that we, that sin gets a bad rap because that's what we all have in common. So if we start there and are free to share and talk about it, we can have real community.
I had mentioned to Dan at lunch today that I happen to be in a congregation that is, because we're always liberal and do the right thing, we have already done, you know, we've done the affirmation and welcome and reconciliation statement from Lutheran Concern for gays and lesbians in our community. And I said, but if they're only as affirmed and welcomed as the rest of us, we're in real trouble, since nobody is affirmed or welcomed or accepted really in this particular congregation. It's a very inhospitable kind of environment. And I think there are a lot of places like that one, which is not to mean it's not superficially hospitable and you can go to the coffee hour and talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
But the denial things are very real.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the 12 steps would be something a person would want to experience rather than give mental assent to, you know.
Right.
It's more than just understanding intellectually what's up there. Right. It's actually experiencing it. And,
right.
You know, in AA, they always say, well, people come to AA and they say, well, how do I do it? And AA always says three things. Go to meetings. Read the big book, get a sponsor, and keep going. Like, well, I belong to you. I've been in 7.5 years, and some people have gone for maybe a couple, 3 years and haven't caught on yet. But they say, now keep going. And then in another 3 or 4 years, all of a sudden, the person will come back and say, gee, I know what you mean. I begin to experience this thing. And the expression they use is, they always keep it simple. They always say, if you talk the talk, pretty soon you'll walk the walk. If you come and listen long enough and soak it in, and you keep coming, and you're willing, the key word is willing, willingness, or acceptance, or surrender, all three go together. Willingness. If you're willing, or accepting, or surrendering, pretty soon you'll walk the walk, and then you're experiencing it, you know? So I like your concept in here of, let's experience something.
Right.
That's a good deal.
I was just gonna say again that it's an experiential movement, which is very different from right teaching.
Yes, that's right.
Assent to right teaching. Yeah. But to use Lutheran categories, I think this process is about works righteousness. You know, you get in, you know, I have to save myself by doing all of these things to avoid the problem. Luther defines sin as curvatio in se. We turn in on ourselves, and it's fear and isolation. Our whole lives become self-obsessed with denial. And then salvation is moving out, being responding to that call of address that moves us out instead of curving in. Another hand, someone? Yeah.
I just want to get clear on how you used willful powerlessness there. Are you talking
like
about the struggle of self-will? Are you talking about the next step where you surrender?
This is the sickness. Mm-hmm. I was in the bookstore this afternoon, and there was like a 3-year-old who wasn't getting his way, and he was powerless to get it, but he was very willful. So this is like a temper tantrum. Right? And we can spend our whole lives in temper tantrums. You know? Whereas, this is our willingness to take positive, powerful action.
Oh, okay. Dan, could you say this, that the 12 steps is only spiritual. And as I heard a woman once say in a group, God works through skin. And I really believe in these 12-step groups, whatever that 12-step group may be, when people gather, that God is at work, and that some of that willing, powerful action is actually the Spirit of God working among the people. I believe that. I see that happen. I've seen it in myself. I've experienced that.
One of the connections...
From the higher power.
One of the connections I would make, and then maybe we should move into the meditation, is that last week Anderson's talked often about how liberation theology is a movement of the people, that academic theologians then come and ponder and write books about. And this is certainly, this is a folk movement that has worked and that has come up through the people, and now clinical psychologists are studying this and trying to figure out why it works and how they can apply it in different ways. But in that sense, it's another folk movement. I am going to invite you to just a short healing meditation, and we're going to do some work on the healing of memory from childhood. I would suggest that you not take the most painful, horrible, abusive experience you've ever had in your life, okay, like incest or something, because we're not equipped to deal with that in this group. But think of and I'll give you some time in silence to find such an experience, but maybe just in grade school in the classroom. But when we're talking about powerlessness, sometimes I notice that, you know, when we're talking about feminism or Latin America, straight white males feel like they can't relate. But I think something we all have in common is that childhood is a real powerless state in our culture. How many times have we been in a grocery store and seen a parent like slug a little kid in public? You know, I mean, there's a lot of humiliation and shaming, that kind of thing. Public school is often that way. We're gonna look for powerlessness and how, and in a childhood experience. And then when we come out of our meditation, we can reflect on how that might still be a dynamic in our own life. I know that not all of us in this room self-identify as Christian. I would like to use, however, in the meditation, the image of Jesus Christ as you understand that image. And I mean that very seriously. I mean, if you're a Unitarian or a goddess worshiper, when I'm suggesting Jesus Christ, I don't mean the Jesus Christ you think some church out there, their image. But whatever comes into your mind as this person, let that person come into this memory and see what happens. Okay, is that agreeable? I don't want anyone to, like, freak out or anything. And we'll just take 5 minutes. So feel free to select. Some people like to stretch out on the floor, but often posture is important if you want to put both feet on the floor and kind of sit upright so that your breathing is unstepped up. First, we'll just do a little body centering. So I would invite you to feel comfortable in your chair. Close your eyes. And just focus your attention on your breathing itself. Let the breath come into your lungs a little deeper than usual. Be conscious of the miracle of breath. Mindful that in the Bible, the word breath and spirit are the same word. Feel your feet on the floor. Feel your legs. Feel that chakra center in your groin, the miracle of creation there. Center in your stomach, where you so often have your feelings, the beating of your heart. Let your shoulders relax, and your arms rest. Your neck works hard holding up that head with all its thoughts. Just let it relax. Allow your face to relax. No need for expressions, just relax. And in the center you are who you've always been. Remember the little girl or the little boy inside you. And bring up a scene in your memory, like a movie, in a classroom or at a family reunion, at home, maybe on the playground, somewhere where your boundaries were being crossed, you weren't being treated right, and as a little person, you were powerless.
I was about 4 or 5 years old, and I can picture exactly where this occurred. My father was visiting with a neighbor friend, and he offered to trade me straight across for the neighbor friend's tractor. And I believed it. It was so real. And it was characteristic of my father to, and this was his sense of humor. He thought it was real cute, I'm sure. But I went away from there. I'm sure I worried for weeks about when that transaction was actually going to occur. And there was never any talk to me. And I don't remember when I let go of it as this isn't going to happen. Maybe I never consciously did. But what I visualized just now was in my aunt and uncle's living room is where this occurred. Christ standing there by the hearth of the fireplace, and when he walked over to me, he didn't just stand by me, he picked me up and held me. And we walked out of the living room outside, and he explained to me about my father being an alcoholic. And he has a lot of really weird things about him, including a sense of humor that really isn't funny and is real scary to kids. And that's just how he is, and he may almost be that way, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't love you. Mm-hmm. And it was just very comforting. I think maybe I'm going to be able to let go of that, mm-hmm. that pain.
Mm-hmm. I have one that was kind of surprising. I'm not really sure I don't understand it. Maybe it's really not clear. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother had a eating disorder and became quite obese, and I had a heart there. And then my only sister became an alcoholic heroin addict, so I'm kind of the only survivor in my family. And, as well as I can, just all of my codependent addiction. But my visualization, I couldn't get clear on exactly which incident, but there were several in grade school that involved my body. And I became fat as a little girl in our first or second grade. And there were a couple of times when I was humiliated by the children, called Daddy Daddy 2x4. And that came up, but then also a couple of really, horribly shaming things. One where I had diarrhea in a classroom, and because I was very, very shy and very afraid of the authority, the teacher, and embarrassed of the other kids, I was afraid to raise my hand and say, I really need to go to the restroom. And so I messed myself up. And then the other one similar to that was in the cafeteria one time around that same age, and I don't know what was going on, but at home there was something else happening, but the food was really gross that day at lunch, and I couldn't eat it, and it was making me really sick, but I was, again, powerless, real afraid of the authority, the mean teachers that had, guard duty in the cafeteria who made you eat everything, and so I actually threw up and was afraid to say anything, and so I actually ate my vomit. And then I went and told my mom, who was obese and had eating disorder, so there's stuff around food and body. And so then after that, she would always come and pick me up and take me out to lunch, and I had real fattening things. I'd go to this hamburger place where I'd pour on the extra secret sauce and everything, and I just kind of blew up my lip. So all those things were kind of overlapping, and I had a meditation once before, quite a few years ago, before I had ever gone back into an organized Christian church. And at that time I had no relationship consciously to Christ, and I had a meditation where you were to find your doctor, physical doctor, but spirit doctor, and what came up for me was Christ. It was very surprising. I kind of didn't even want it, but he was there. So that same doctor came to this powerless, terrified child who kind of self-abused, herself, and took me by the hand and led me almost out of my body, like in a Spielberg, film, the special Spielberg film, kind of the spirit kind of left the body and the little child went with Christ and didn't go to the hamburger joint with the mother either, but went off and began to kind of fly, that lightness, and then went out into the desert. And I was very clearly instructed that for my time here at Holden, I should fast. Think about the food philosophy of Holden.
I remembered a time when My mother used to spank me a lot, really hard. She made it very clear to me that I was not to try to avoid her blows, because if I did, then she would hit me harder. And that I remember this one incident where I had done something that she didn't like, and I don't remember what it was that I did, but I was outside and I remember her coming after me. And I saw her coming and it was real frightening. And she had a willow in her hand. We had a big willow tree in our yard. And she wanted me to go home. I wasn't at home at the time. She wanted me to go home. I must have been at the neighbor's, and she started switching my legs. And I got real confused because I wasn't supposed to try to avoid her blows, and so I stood there. And what she wanted me to do was move and go home while she switched me. And she then finally, when I didn't move, she said, "Move, stupid." And that the powerlessness came in not being able to interpret what she wanted, and no matter what I did, it wasn't the right thing. And during the meditation, when Christ came in, immediately the word acceptance came into my mind, and he came over and stood beside me and said to my mother, "Stop. This isn't going to help. You must accept her." It was really neat. That was what I always wanted for my mother, but didn't know what I got.
So it was a real liberating message. Not that you should accept abuse, she should accept you as your mom.
And maybe the reverse too, of that I should not accept the abuse, but I should accept my mother too, which I was never able to do before she died.
The image of we humans as the the tree that grows with the rings. We don't really grow up. We grow in concentric circles, and those our inner childs are always there. And that's really where we're acting out of. The healing of these memories is so important for us to go on in our spiritual journeys. And it's something that if our religion is a little pet tripping, we're not going on a spiritual journey. So a lot of what we did this evening is a technique used in secular programs, usually referred to as reparenting, and often it's not Jesus but ourself now who goes back into that scene of how do we treat our own inner child. But why I like to use Jesus in terms of my faith heritage is because I can't do that for myself in the current situation. I can't imagine who I'm going to be 20 years from now and then have that person come and stand beside me. But, you know, when I'm in these, even last week, Jesus was standing there beside me a lot of times as I go through conflicted situations. And it helps center me in the same way that Christ can be there in our memory. And if we use that as a spiritual exercise, then it becomes easier to visualize Christ with us in the present, too, as we experience the healing presence in our past. Anyone else?
And that was one of the things that came out of the vision that I was kind of totally expected. When you, I don't remember what you said, but in terms of coming back to the room here, I don't know if we were explicitly supposed to bring Jesus with us or he was kind of bringing us back or not, but that's what happened for me. And it was real interesting. One thing that I hadn't expected at all was in the being a little boy in the imaging, and then as I walked back with Jesus to this room, I grew up. Right alongside him, and it was like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then we were, by the time we got to the room, we were companions in some sense. It was really just a real warm companionship of feeling like here was a deep personal friend who'd been with me all my life and I hadn't even known it, now was standing right beside me.
And how different when we're in our theological debates and we're debating the question of authority, how different it is to have that companionship with authority as opposed to living in an unhealed child where that authority has to be this powerful figure up here who's telling me what to do, or I don't feel secure. And I think there's some spiritual healing.
Just about a month ago I read the article, because in discussion has come up about feminist spirituality, and then a couple people asked, well, what's masculine spirituality then? So the teacher wanted to bring something to the next class, and in the very last paragraph of this, I was talking about, well, the article talked a little bit about naming God, and the very last paragraph it said, well, why can't we call God friend? And I'd never read that, you know, in a serious theological piece. And I thought, well, why can't we? Why does God have to be Father? You know, a lot of us had very authoritarian fathers. And so God, for me, has to be someone who always has an answer. And may not be the right one. And it's probably an answer that I don't want to hear. Which, why does no one ever talk about that? Why do we never even consider the possibility of calling God friend?
Well, you're not, because you're not going to the right church.
The
Gospel of John, the 15th chapter, the 15th verse. Jesus said, in John's Last Supper story, Jesus says, I do not call you servants or slaves, but I call you friend, because a servant doesn't know what his master is doing, and everything I've received from God I've shared with you, so I call you friend. And whereas some branches of the church focus on Peter and that confession, the reason the Quakers call themselves friends is that they're founded on that verse. And a whole different spirituality developed over the community of people with the inner light of Christ. And the Quakers' place in social justice issues ends up in a real different place. And it's all about basing a theology of friendship as opposed to a theology of patriarchy.
Also, an insight I had thinking about the exercise
you know, while visioning the image of light, the Christ image, next to my child, I felt a strong sense of nurturing and love and just, you know, being enveloped in this wonderful light and loving energy. And that feeling, you know, it reflects, I mean, with all of us and listening to the other stories and the love that I felt towards those sharing and wanting to be in there too, you know, holding that child and caring for it. It's our own power to nurture ourselves, to nurture one another, and to heal. And just by visualizing it in that context, we're really getting in touch with our own empowerment, our own personal empowerment, and our own capacity that we haven't really acknowledged in that way. We've always put it outside.
Right.
But it came from within. It was an inner experience. And that was very effective for me.
In my life, I've had Christ-like figures, people I know who've been Christ to me. Like when I was about 3, I did a flip on the sofa, and I landed feet first on my mother's glass coffee top table and smashed the glass all over the living room. And she grabbed me, gonna spank me. And my grandma, who was the Christ figure, took me from her and said, it was her mother, and says, "Hilder, give me David." And she sat me down in the chair, and I was feeling enough remorse. I was feeling guilty and shame and fear and all that. And she comforted me and patted me. She said, "David, that's all right, David, that's all right, you're forgiven." That's one of my most vivid childhood memories. She was Christ to me, and that's how I remember Dada. We call her Dada. Mm-hmm. That's precious.
In a liturgical form, I was struck last night during the Eucharist service when we recited together the statement of faith, not the Apostles' Creed, but the statement of faith in which it says that Jesus Christ is revealed in our own joys and sorrows. That's where I have my personal relationship with Christ. It's in my own life. That's a powerful story. Dada is Christ. Revealed to us. And then my theology is when we find that also revealed in the scripture, because we can relate to it. I recognize myself in scripture from my own experiences. Anyone else? I love hearing stories.
Well, I'll share my story, but I have to say, I had real trouble using the kind of imagine Jesus coming part of it. And I'm not quite sure. I've been sitting here trying to understand why that just wouldn't come for me. And the story was one I wasn't quite as young as you were talking about, but something I've been struggling with a lot, which was right after my father had died. And I was 11, and my mother was crazy, okay, probably crazy for good reason, but she was nonetheless crazy. And I have a vivid memory of spending about a year alone, and wanting to go out, but then being sort of not a very suitable child in the outer world, and so therefore getting kind of dumped on there, and so then wanting to come back home, but there's nobody there, sort of trying to work on this image of kind of how to be able to feel free to go reach out. But I somehow tonight, and I have to just say it, that it was a very hard to evoke a Jesus image that wasn't, I kept getting, only could get sentimental ones to come along, and I didn't like it. You know, I sort of like, come on, give me a break, you know. I guess in fact what happened was I got the 11-year-old's Jesus, okay, and the 11-year-old, and I now have such sort of powerful feelings about that saccharine Jesus that to even imagine this was very difficult for me than it was like. And I think you and I were in a session earlier where Larry was talking about the power things, and I think one of the things I need to have is a Jesus that's more powerful than the one that came, that was the only one I could image in this story. So I sort of didn't want that Jesus there because it was sort of ineffectual, as a matter of fact. That Jesus just sort of does mamby-pamby things in Sunday school, but what good does that do you in the real world? So it was a kind of a...
And the tragedy of our upbringing that takes a powerful Jesus, a healing Jesus.
Yeah, it's like a hard, not a particularly pleasant sensation.
It's time that we close. There's a great resource for you, a woman named Flora Wallner. She's written lots of books. Her husband is the New Testament professor at Pacific School of Religion, and she is a professor in her own right and teaches prayer. She's written about 5 books on spirit with various titles on spirituality, prayer, human wholeness. She's a United Church of Christ minister, and she's probably 65 years old now. She was in her early ministry was dedicated to social justice, and she was a young civil rights marcher and so on and so forth until she got totally burned out, and through her own recovery process she developed a strong feminist Christian spiritual insight, and her ministry now is primarily healing clergy, and she writes wonderfully. But as you take this kind of thing home to your own congregations and different spiritual exercises we'll do through the week, she also is a good resource of things that groups in your church can do, different types of prayer together that have a healing, soothing, and hopefully inspiring influence on us in our life together as the church. So thanks for coming.
Dan, before we close, I'm just wondering, and maybe Dan would have some insights as well. This was a very powerful session for me, and I'm wondering if it was powerful for others, and if there's someone in the room who would like to talk to somebody about something that came up. Can we name some resource people that they could try to identify in the next, maybe sometime this evening or tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Are there people on staff, Dan, that people could seek out?
Yeah, there were plenty of folks. It's when we talked to me or Dan on staff. Carol Tomer is the village pastor, so I think we'll be willing to talk to people. Jackie Brolson and Barb Rossing are both some of the folks. If those names don't mean anything, the photos will be up on the wall there and you can seek them out. Scott Hossard is the director out of the village right now.
And I was just about to suggest that besides Dan and myself and these other people, that we just, that as before we leave, we kind of stand and form a circle and hold each other and look at each other as resources, having gone through this experience together, that the next time we run into each other on the way into the next meal, we can talk about our spirituality and share that instead of how the Red Sox are doing or whatever.